Chapter 49. It all begins, as I've told you, with a man called Brown, apostrophe ran the opening sentence of Marlowe's narrative. You who have knocked about the Western Pacific must have heard of him. He was the show ruffian on the Australian coast, not that he was often to be seen there, but because he was always trotted out in the stories of lawless life a visitor from home is treated to. And the mildest of these stories which were told about him from Cape York to Eden Bay, was more than enough to hang a man, if told in the right place. They never failed to let you know, too, that he was supposed to be the son of a baronet. Be it as it may, it is certain he had deserted from a home ship in the early gold-digging days, and in a few years became talked about as the terror of this or that group of islands in Polynesia. He would kidnap natives, he would strip some lonely white trader to the very pajamas he stood in, and after he had robbed the poor devil, he would as likely as not invite him to fight a duel with shotguns on the beach, which would have been fair enough as these things go, if the other man hadn't been by that time already half dead with fright. Brown was a latter-day buccaneer, sorry enough, like his more celebrated prototypes. But what distinguished him from his contemporary brother ruffians, like Bully Hayes or the mellifluous Peace, or that perfumed, dundery-whiskered, dandified scoundrel known as Dirty Dick, was the arrogant temper of his misdeeds, and a vehement scorn for mankind at large, and for his victims in particular. The others were merely vulgar and greedy brutes, but he seemed moved by some complex intention. He would rob a man, as if only to demonstrate his poor opinion of the creature, and he would bring to the shooting or maiming of some quiet unoffending stranger a savage and vengeful earnestness fit to terrify the most reckless of desperados. In the days of his greatest glory he owned an armed bark, manned by a mixed crew of Kanakas and runaway whalers, and boasted, I don't know with what truth, of being financed on the quiet by a most respectable firm of copra merchants. Later on he ran off, it was reported, with the wife of a missionary, a very young girl from Clapham Way, who had married the mild, flat-footed fellow in a moment of enthusiasm, and, suddenly transplanted to Melanesia, lost her bearing somehow. It was a dark story. She was ill at the time he carried her off, and died on board his ship. It is said as the most wonderful put of the tale, that over her body he gave way to an outburst of somber and violent grief. His luck left him too, very soon after. He lost his ship on some rocks off Malaita, and disappeared for a time, as though he had gone down with her. He is heard of next at Nuka Hiva, where he bought an old French schooner out of government service. What creditable enterprise he might have had in view when he made that purchase I can't say, but it is evident that what with high commissioners, consuls, men of war, and international control, the South Seas were getting too hot to hold gentlemen of his kidney. Clearly he must have shifted the scene of his operations farther west, because a year later he plays an incredibly audacious, but not a very profitable part, in a serio-comic business in Manila Bay, in which a peculating governor and an absconding treasurer are the principal figures. Thereafter he seems to have hung around the Philippines, in his rotten schooner battling with an adverse fortune, till at last, running his appointed course, he sails into Jim's history, a blind accomplice of the dark powers. His tale goes that, when a Spanish patrol cutter captured him, he was simply trying to run a few guns for the insurgents. If so, then I can't understand what he was doing off the south coast of Mindanao. My belief, however, is that he was blackmailing the native villages along the coast. The principal thing is that the cutter, throwing a guard on board, made him sail in company towards Zamboanga. On the way, for some reason or other, both vessels had to call at one of these new Spanish settlements which never came to anything in the end, where there was not only a civil official in charge on shore, but a good stout coasting schooner lying at anchor in the little bay. And this craft, in every way much better than his own, Brown made up his mind to steal. He was down on his luck as he told me himself. The world he had bullied for 20 years with fierce aggressive disdain had yielded him nothing in the way of material advantage except a small bag of silver dollars, which was concealed in his cabin, so that he devil himself couldn't smell it out. And that was all, absolutely all. He was tired of his life, and not afraid of death. But this man, who would stake his existence on a whim with a bitter and jeering recklessness, stood in mortal fear of imprisonment. He had an unreasoning cold sweat, nerve-shaking, blood-to-water-turning sort of horror at the bare possibility of being locked up, the sort of terror a superstitious man would feel at the thought of being embraced by a specter. Therefore, the civil official who came on board to make a preliminary investigation into the capture investigated arduously all day long, and only went ashore after dark, muffled up in a cloak, and taking great care not to let Brown's little all clink in its bag. Afterwards, being a man of his word, he contrived the very next evening, I believe, to send off the government cutter on some urgent bit of special service. As her commander could not spare a prize crew, he contented himself by taking away, before he left, all the sails of Brown's schooner to the very last rag, and took good care to tow his two boats onto the beach a couple of miles off. But in Brown's crew there was a Solomon Islander, kidnapped in his youth and devoted to Brown, who was the best man of the whole gang. That fellow swam off to the coaster 500 yards or so with the end of a warp made up of all the running gear unrove for the purpose. The water was smooth, and the bay dark, like the inside of a cow, as Brown described it. The Solomon Islander clambered over the bulwarks with the end of the rope in his teeth. The crew of the coaster all tagels were ashore having a jollification in the native village. The two shipkeepers left on board woke up suddenly and saw the devil. It had glittering eyes and leaped quick as lightning about the deck. They fell on their knees, paralyzed with fear, crossing themselves and mumbling prayers. With a long knife he found in the caboose, the Solomon Islander, without interrupting their orisons, stabbed first one, then the other. With the same knife he set to sawing patiently at the choir cable till suddenly it parted under the blade with a splash. Then in the silence of the bay he let out a cautious shout, and Brown's gang, who meantime had been peering and straining their hopeful ears in the darkness, began to pull gently at their end of the warp. In less than 5 minutes the two schooners came together with a slight shock and a creak of spars. Brown's crowd transferred themselves without losing an instant, taking with them their firearms and a large supply of ammunition. They were 16 in all. Two runaway blue jackets, a lanky deserter from a Yankee man of war, a couple of simple, blonde Scandinavians, a mulatto of sorts, one bland Chinaman who cooked, and the rest of the nondescript spawn of the South Seas. None of them cared. Brown bent them to his will, and Brown, indifferent to gallows, was running away from the specter of a Spanish prison. He didn't give them the time to transship enough provisions. The weather was calm, the air was charged with dew, and when they cast off the ropes and set sail to a faint offshore draft there was no flutter in the damp canvas. Their old schooner seemed to detach itself gently from the stolen craft and slip away silently, together with the black mass of the coast, into the night. They got clear away. Brown related to me in detail their passage down the Straits of Macassar. It is a harrowing and desperate story. They were short of food and water. They boarded several native craft, and got a little from each. With a stolen ship, Brown did not dare to put into any port, of course. He had no money to buy anything, no papers to show, and no lie plausible enough to get him out again. An Arab bark, under the Dutch flag, surprised one night at anchor off Paolo Lot, yielded a little dirty rice, a bunch of bananas, and a cask of water. 3 days of squally misty weather from the northeast shot the schooner across the Java Sea. The yellow muddy waves drenched that collection of hungry ruffians. They sighted mail boats moving on their appointed routes, past well-found home ships with rusty iron sides anchored in the shallow sea waiting for a change of weather, or the turn of the tide. An English gunboat, white and trim, with two slim masts, crossed their bows one day in the distance. And on another occasion a Dutch corvette, black and heavily sparred, loomed upon their quarter, steaming dead slow in the mist. They slipped through unseen or disregarded, a wan, sallow-faced band of utter outcasts, enraged with hunger and hunted by fear. Brown's idea was to make for Madagascar, where he expected, on grounds not altogether illusory, to sell the schooner in Tamatave, and no questions asked, or perhaps obtain some more or less forged papers for her. Yet before he could face the long passage across the Indian Ocean, food was wanted, water too. Perhaps he had heard of Patchison, or perhaps he just only happened to see the name written in small letters on the chart, probably that of a largish village up a river in a native state, perfectly defenseless, far from the beaten tracks of the sea, and from the ends of submarine cables. He had done that kind of thing before in the way of business, and this now was an absolute necessity, a question of life and death, or rather of liberty. Of liberty. He was sure to get provisions, bullocks, rice, sweet potatoes. The sorry gang licked their chops. A cargo of produce for the schooner perhaps could be extorted, and, who knows, some real ringing coined money. Some of these chiefs and village headmen can be made to part freely. He told me he would have roasted their toes, rather than be balked. I believe him. His men believed him too. They didn't cheer loud, being a dumb pack, but made ready wolfishly. Luck served him as to weather. A few days of calm would have brought unmentionable horrors on board that schooner, but with the help of land and sea breezes, in less than a week, after clearing the Sunda Straits, he anchored off the Batu Kring mouth within a pistol shot of the fishing village. 14 of them packed into the schooner's long boat, which was big, having been used for cargo work, and started up the river, while two remained in charge of the schooner with food enough to keep starvation off for 10 days. The tide and wind helped, and early one afternoon the big white boat under a ragged sail shouldered its way before the sea breeze into Patchison Reach, manned by 14 assorted scarecrows glaring hungrily ahead, and fingering the breech blocks of cheap rifles. Brown calculated upon the terrifying surprise of his appearance. They sailed in with the last of the flood. The Rajah's stockade gave no sign. The first houses on both sides of the stream seemed deserted. A few canoes were seen up the reach in full flight. Brown was astonished at the size of the place. A profound silence reigned. The wind dropped between the houses. Two oars were got out and the boat held on upstream, the idea being to effect a lodgment in the center of the town before the inhabitants could think of resistance. It seems, however, that the headman of the fishing village at Batu Kring had managed to send off a timely warning. When the longboat came abreast of the mosque which Dorman had built, a structure with gables and roof finials of carved coral, the open space before it was full of people. A shout went up, and was followed by a clash of gongs all up the river. From a point above, two little brass six-pounders were discharged, and the round shot came skipping down the empty reach, spurting glittering jets of water in the sunshine. In front of the mosque, a shouting lot of men began firing in volleys that whipped athwart the current of the river. An irregular, rolling fusillade was opened on the boat from both banks, and Brown's men replied with a wild rapid fire. The oars had been got in. The turn of the tide at high water comes on very quickly in that river, and the boat in midstream, nearly hidden in smoke, began to drift back stern foremost. Along both shores the smoke thickened also, lying below the roofs, in a level streak as you may see a long cloud cutting the slope of a mountain. A tumult of war cries, the vibrating clang of gongs, the deep snoring of drums, yells of rage, crashes of volley firing, made an awful din, in which Brown sat confounded, but steady at the tiller, working himself into a fury of hate and rage against those people who dared to defend themselves. Two of his men had been wounded, and he saw his retreat cut off below the town by some boats that had put off from Tungualang's stockade. There were six of them, full of men. While he was thus beset, he perceived the entrance of the narrow creek, the same which Jim had jumped at low water. It was then brimful. Steering the longboat in, they landed, and, to make a long story short, they established themselves on a little knoll about 900 yards from the stockade, which, in fact, they commanded from that position. The slopes of the knoll were bare, but there were a few trees on the summit. They went to work cutting these down for a breastwork, and were fairly entrenched before dark. Meantime, the Rajah's boats remained in the river with curious neutrality. When the sun set, the glow of many brushwood blazes lighted on the river front, and between the double line of houses on the land side threw into black relief the roofs, the groups of slender palms, the heavy clumps of fruit trees. Brown ordered the grass round his position to be fired. A low ring of thin flames under the slow ascending smoke wriggled rapidly down the slopes of the knoll. Here and there a dry bush caught with a tall, vicious roar. The conflagration made a clear zone of fire for the rifles of the small party, and expired smoldering on the edge of the forests, and along the muddy bank of the creek. A strip of jungle luxuriating in a damp hollow between the knoll and the Rajah's stockade stopped it on that side with a great crackling and detonations of bursting bamboo stems. The sky was somber, velvety, and swarming with stars. The blackened ground smoked quietly with low creeping wisps, till a little breeze came on, and blew everything away. Brown expected an attack to be delivered, as soon as the tide had flowed enough again, to enable the war boats which had cut off his retreat to enter the creek. At any rate, he was sure there would be an attempt to carry off his long boat, which lay below the hill, a dark high lump on the feeble sheen of a wet mud flat. But no move of any sort was made by the boats in the river. Over the stockade and the Rajah's buildings, Brown saw their lights on the water. They seemed to be anchored across the stream. Other lights afloat were moving in the reach, crossing and recrossing from side to side. There were also lights twinkling motionless upon the long walls of houses up the reach, as far as the bend, and more still beyond, others isolated inland. The loom of the big fires disclosed buildings, roofs, black piles as far as he could see. It was an immense place. The 14 desperate invaders lying flat behind the felled trees raised their chins to look over at the stir of that town that seemed to extend upriver for miles and swarm with thousands of angry men. They did not speak to each other. Now and then they would hear a loud yell, or a single shot rang out, fired very far somewhere. But round their position everything was still, dark, silent. They seemed to be forgotten, as if the excitement keeping awake all the population had nothing to do with them, as if they had been dead already. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.